KIOS-FM presents another luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Thursday, March 16, 2006, for broadcast at this time. Today's speakers will be Dave Kotok, veteran journalist with the Omaha World-Herald, and World Herald staff photographer Jeff Bundy. Their topic will be Covering Nebraskans at War. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of KIOS-FM, the Omaha Press Club, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Doug Roseman, a member of the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee.
Good afternoon, everyone. If I may have your attention, and please continue eating. Go ahead and continue with your lunch. I am Doug Roseman. I'm a member of the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee. And on behalf of our committee, I'd like to welcome you and our KIOS radio audience to today's event. But first, a commercial. Each month, the Education Committee sponsors a noon forum involving a person or a subject we think will be of interest to our members and the general public. As some of you now know, you don't have to be a Press Club member to attend our events. So spread the word about us and bring your friends along with you. Our next forum is going to be Thursday, April 20th, and will feature Douglas County Sheriff Tim Dunning and Amy Miller, an attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union. They are going to be discussing housing restrictions on convicted sex offenders. This is a topic that's been in the news of late. So mark April 20th on your calendars and join us at that noon forum. Also, some of our forums are available on DVDs and can be purchased through CP Media. If interested, simply contact the Press Club. End of commercial. But before we get started, here are the ground rules for today's session. Number one, please turn off your cell phones or put them on vibrate. Thank you. Next, our speakers will take your questions following their presentation. We have put paper and pencils at your tables. So please jot down any questions you would like to ask, and they will be collected by Mr. Gary Kerr and brought to me. As we have only this microphone up here, I will read the questions. They will be sitting down at the table, and they will answer your questions from there. That's our commercial and the ground rules. So let's begin our program. Today, I am honored to be able to introduce you to C. David Dave Kotok, a writer, and Jeffrey Jeff Bundy, a photographer, both of whom are on the staff of the Omaha World-Herald. Jeff and Dave spent 45 days in Iraq and Kuwait, bringing a heartland focus to the war there. Their work featured stories and pictures of Nebraska people, both there and back home, all impacted by the events of the war. As you should know, sending stories and photos from a war zone is a dangerous job. According to a recent report from Reporters Without Borders, 79 journalists have died in Iraq since the start of the war in 2003. In contrast, 63 journalists were killed in the two-decades-long Vietnam War. And 35 have been kidnapped, including Jill Carroll of the Christian Science Monitor, who was kidnapped on January 7th and is still among the missing. Margaret Burke White, the photojournalist for Life magazine, said it best when she said, "War correspondents see a great deal of the world. Our obligation is to pass it on to others." Dave and Jeff have accomplished that very well for our community through their work for the Omaha World-Herald. Please join with me in welcoming David Kotok and Jeff Bundy, who will tell us about their experiences covering Nebraskans at war.
Thanks so much, Doug. We've made a lot of appearances since we returned in late October, and this group is a little different since it's the press club. We thought we'd talk a little bit about the journalism and the what we face as journalists rather than trying to describe everything about that we learned about Iraq. That doesn't mean we won't answer any of your questions on any subject that we might raise or any questions that you might have. We look forward to your questions. The one exception would be is we are not, neither of us are Chuck Hagel. We are not going to discuss whether the war was right or wrong. That's actually beyond our pay grade. We can discuss what we observed there, though. You know, as Doug mentioned, covering wars is can be a difficult mission, but it goes to the heart of the American tradition of journalism. I think that's what really attracted both Jeff and I to this assignment and led us to volunteer for the World Herald's going to Iraq. You know, since the Revolutionary War, we've had reporters with our troops. And certainly since Matthew Brady brought the images of war first to the public as the photographer in the Civil War, photographers have been there with our soldiers in combat. So it's a grand tradition of American journalism, and it's a critical one. Doug mentioned the number of people who have lost their lives there. I think Jeff and I feel that one of our problems we have today is that because Iraq is so dangerous that we have too few journalists there, not too many. The stories are not getting out the way they should. This is an important thing for Americans, media to be there to see what is going on. It is part of our role, just as holding our local politicians accountable is one of the main roles for the, you know, for the local press here. It is also to see what is going on in overseas with our troops. And this really comes home and in the way we designed our what we would cover when we were going there. I'm not on the big picture, I can't compete with John Burns of the New York Times. He's covered wars all over the world. That was not our objective, to tell the huge story, the big story. It's really our objective to tell the little stories of the real people who serve there. And one of the things we began to realize after the initial invasion, where thousands of reporters and photographers were embedded with our troops, they all kind of pulled out. Then the war got dirty and grimy. And the press, to a large degree, was drawn into the circle of the Green Zone in Baghdad. And the stories seemed to all read the same. Day after day, the steady drumbeat. And I hate to say it, the steady formula journalism. 13 American soldiers killed and injured today, among 85 people killed in Iraq. The Shias and Sunnis are still have not gotten their act together, and the government is struggling to form a unity, you know, government. Every day, the AP wire out of Baghdad was reading the same, almost putting us all to sleep to what was going on there. So we decided there was another mission, especially with all of the National Guard troops that were there, and that's really why the World Herald, I think, decided, and the World Herald has a tradition, just like all American journalism, of sending soldiers to war. We had, you know, we've had reporters from the World Herald in World War II, in Vietnam, and now and the first Gulf War, and now during this conflict. And they're to tell the stories of our men and women who are serving over there. And I'm, you know, this is a plug for the World Herald. I don't think there's another institution in the state that was capable of sending people and undertaking the expenses to send people to Iraq as the World Herald was. One of the key decisions that was made was to send a photographer as well as a reporter. A lot of papers cheaped out, in my view, and we might have too. and sending only a reporter to tell the story. But these are vivid stories, and they needed a photographer. And I want to say that we had not only sent a great photographer in Jeff Bundy there, but from my experience, we also sent somebody, a photographer, who is a solid, solid journalist. We were often would go separate ways, and I knew, he knew I had a couple eyes that I could look for pictures, and I knew he had a couple ears and a good sense for what the news was. And he would come back with stories to give me, and then I might write them, but the concepts came from him. So we kind of doubled our power, both, and it worked out well for the paper, for our readers, and I think for the two of us. One of our many challenges when we went there was technology, because the way wars are reported on has changed in the digital age. And I was in charge of logistics. Jeff, on the other hand, was in charge of technology. And I think Jeff's going to explain some of the technological things we face as and some of the problems we face in Iraq to get those stories back and get them back at a timely basis.
As we all know, with the evolution of the internet and everything, journalists' jobs have gotten easier and harder because with the availability to file our stories so quickly, editors want them immediately. You know, you used to be able to have a little bit of time because you would have to use a phone line or something like that to transmit. But now with the internet, you can walk into any Starbucks and pound out your story in photos and file. Well, that works here in the U.S., but, you know, in Iraq, you can't go to Panera Bread and sit down and jump on their open network and file. So for us, it was figuring out how to get our stories home. You know, the World Herald doesn't cover international stories every day, so it was a real learning process for us. I spent a lot of time on the phone visiting with newspapers that cover these events, the New York Times, L.A. Times, Miami Herald, and started asking them how they cover events like this and get their stories home, because the military, of course, has satellite connections and internet, but they don't allow civilians to use their transmitting capabilities due to for security reasons. So after spending a lot of time on the phone and asking questions, we found out that the unit everybody was using in theater was called an RBGAN. And it's hard to believe, but this little piece of equipment here is basically a satellite uplink. And what you'd have to do is you'd have to go outside and you'd have to find a clear view to the southeast. And you plug it into your computer and a little GPS would come up and it would tell you the coordinates you need to do. And you would turn the RBGAN and tilt it until you'd get a strong enough signal. And then you just hit your internet Explorer or Safari or whatever, and all of a sudden, you know, you're hooked up to the internet. And we would just go to we transmit pictures with a file transfer protocol, FTP, and I could get right into the World Herald, drag our pictures over, drag our stories over, and in 15 seconds we'd move a picture, you know. And it was mind-boggling, because this equipment only works in the Mideast and in that region. So we bought all this equipment and our sat phone, which only works in Iran, Iraq, Chad, that area, and we couldn't test it out here. So you get all this equipment shipped to you, you know, and we're talking to other newspapers and they're like going, don't worry about it. It's easy. You just point it towards the sky and it'll work, you know. So now I'm telling my boss, okay, we're going to spend this money, buy this equipment. The IT department isn't buying into it because they can't touch it and make it work. And, you know, it's going to work. Well, we got to Kuwait City and it was like we're looking at each other and it's like, well, let's find out if we're going to sink or swim and set it up. And it worked. One of the interesting things is that you buy the service by the meg. So however much information you push or pull is what you pay for. Well, here's question number two. The New York Times just has an open account with these people and gets billed monthly. Well, we were going to only be there for 2 months, so we had to buy prepaid megs. You know, how many megs do you buy? You know, so that was kind of a quandary. but we ended up not using everything we bought. We bought 200 megs, and I think we used about half of it. But as we went along in different forward operating bases, they had internet access for the soldiers, which was available to us. So anytime that I had the ability to jump on the internet and use, basically poach somebody else's internet, I did to send pictures home because I didn't want to waste all of our megs. One of the more dicey times we had was we were at a forward operating base called Korean Village. And with the 9-hour difference, it was great. I mean, it's the first time I've ever been 9 hours ahead of my editors. So we kind of had this time to work. And, you know, we'd come in off of a mission and then, you know, well, should we, you know, start working our stories? No, it's only 7 in the morning. Let's go eat supper, you know, and we'd go eat. Well, at Korean Village, it's pitch black. We're out in the middle of nowhere, and we're on the second story of this building, and we get the Arbogan lined up, and it's a beautiful night, and Dave and I are looking at the Big Dipper camp. You know, it's like we're back home seeing the stars. And the screen of a Macintosh really is bright when it's dark out. And one of these Marines came up to us and said, you know, guys, I wouldn't be standing that close to the screen because it's illuminating you, and we have taken sniper fire before. So, you know, I took my shirt off and put it over the screen instead of the two of us standing around the computer watching the little dog run as the pictures transmit. We're walking around like chickens, you know. Is it still moving? Yeah. So that's what we did there. So that was kind of the technology hurdle.
Yeah, at Korean Village, it was a little scary because, you know, it was so tempting because we were staying at what was called the VIP quarters, which was a wood hut. And but it had two lines in it, two Ethernet lines, one blue and one red. Well, we knew what these were. One was medium security and one was top secret. So you're tempted to plug your computer right into the Ethernet, but we knew, you know, you plug into the blue one, it instantly recognized that you've got an inappropriate computer, so they'd have to take our computer. We plug into the red one, they'd have to kill us. So that's why we were on top of the roof. And this modern communications, I mean, the way we filed and having that 9 hours was critical because our assignment was really to file daily. So really turn it around and grind it out as quick as possible. And at the same time, we were trying to do stories. And part of the idea was at war and at home. And none of us knew how the at home part would work. And that was not our responsibility. We just hoped the people like Henry Cordes and others who did these could pull them off. And we didn't want them to read the same. You know, mom's sorry that her son's over there, wah, wah, wah. And, you know, day after day, one or two of those were great. But we ended up finding compelling stories at home that helped really bring the story. Because when we were following the National Guard, which was our primary focus, you're talking about, you know, people who are part of our everyday communities, our policemen, our teachers. You know, one of the at-home and away stories we did was on Jeff Searcy, the captain of the 167th Cav in Ramadi, who commanded a real combat unit. Well, the story at home was, you know what? The coach of the Sheldon football team wasn't on the sidelines anymore. He was at war. So we could be Friday night with the captain's former team, and at the same time tell the story of, you know, he's the captain commanding men at war instead of boys on a football field. And it made more compelling and brought, we hope, we think, helped bring the war home closer and made its impact felt more at home. But one of the odd things was, perhaps the most famous picture and probably one of the best stories didn't even involve a Nebraskan. It involved a Marine gunnery sergeant from California, which became this picture became both an icon for the military and for this war. You will find it as a screensaver for Marines all through the world, and but it also tells an important story in many ways, and I thought Jeff would tell us how he got this shot and what it really symbolizes. Jeff?
Well, this was our welcoming party to Ramadi. This was our first full day there, and the brigade we were with had lost five soldiers that day in two separate IED attacks. Three guys were killed in a Humvee, and two guys were lost in a Bradley. What the Nebraska National Guard's job there is QRF, which is quick response. And what they do is they provide security for Marine EOD bomb techs. After events like this happen, the bomb techs go out and do post-blast analysis of the crater site, the destruction to the vehicles to try to figure out the newest techniques that the insurgents are using, and they also look for secondary IEDs. Well, we were on a dismounted patrol on our way up to the first Bradley, and our first story was Captain Searcy, and he had the point taking security. So that means I'm in the front trying to shoot him and move along this road, and we come along the crater with the Bradley about 20 yards away on its side. And this hole was 4 foot by 8 foot. I mean, and this is my first day, and I'm looking at this hole going, wow, and this Bradley is on its side, and it's just, you know, it's all new. I've never been in the military, but it's just taking it all in. Well, the Marine bomb techs are crazy. These guys get $200 a month pay differential to be bomb techs. Well, Burkhart jumps in the hole of the blast, and armed with a knife, he starts picking around because that's how they look for other, you know, other munitions that haven't gone off. Well, in all of the chaos, one of the Nebraska guys that was with the gunnery sergeant started yelling for the captain to come back towards the blast site. So he jumps up and we start running back towards the hole. Well, then all of a sudden, gunnery sergeant looks up and yells IED. Well, Searcy grabbed me and pushed me down, and as we were going down, the secondary blast went off. And, you know, I'm on the ground and the explosion goes off, you know, and you get up and you look back towards the hole, and here's a guy with his boots pointed down, and I thought he was dead. I mean, I just was for sure he was dead. They flew in the medevac. They got him sitting up. I start making frames of him, getting him set up. They get him to his feet. He turns towards the city of Ramadi and flips it off and walks back to the medevac, and they fly him away. Well, the reason he did that was he had three new EOD Marines with him. It was their first mission. He did not want them to see him carried off on a litter. And the other thing is that the insurgents a lot of times videotape these attacks. And we know this because the brigade had recovered videotapes of their own men being blown up by suicide bombers and by them being sniped. And Burkhart figured he was being videotaped, so he just gave him the bird and went to the medevac, and away he went. Well, you know, this is a lot of things going on, and, you know, so they fly him out. The other Marines do the post-blast analysis, and we push on to the Humvee where the other three guys are. Well, when we get back into camp, you know, Dave looks at me and asks me how my first day was, you know. It was pretty intense.
At the chance of embarrassing Jeff a little bit, I've said, you know, it's one thing to be, in this case, in the wrong place at the right time, which he was, to get this shot, but you still have to make the frame. And Jeff had the coolness of mind after checking that all of his body parts were attached to shoot this picture. We were under a lot of pressure over there, as you might imagine. The World Herald had gone to all this expense. But as I like to say, the greatest pressure came from my wife, who told me, if you're going to be gone from me for 7 weeks, the stories better be damn good. So that was even worse than what Larry King told me before I left. I think it worked in the end because of some simple rules that I think apply to journalism anywhere and every day. What we went after was, you know, we didn't follow the pack. The pack was all in Baghdad, and the pack, you know, ran to the briefings and made calls. We were out with the troops, so we were away from the pack. It was kind of interesting to us after we were in Ramadi for a lot of times. When we got there, they said they had never seen a reporter out there, or very few. By the time we were leaving, there were lots of reporters in Ramadi, so we were lucky enough in a way, to be at a place that had been underreported in the past and had become the hotbed of insurgent activities while we were there. It's always good to cover people, you know, compelling people who find themselves in extraordinary circumstances always create compelling stories. And that's one of the things we were lucky enough to be with. And then we just had to tell their stories and try to write them and illustrate them in a way that invited people to relate to them. So in the end, it was one of the more satisfying things in my career. But I think for both of us, it turned out to be a very, you know, gratifying experience to be there, especially since we came back safe and sound. We hoped, you know, we went there to tell the personal stories, the small stories, not trying to tell the big stories. I have the sense, and I would like to believe, that in telling these small stories, we maybe gave our readers a chance at a bigger story, that they saw how our soldiers live, how they fight, how the things they have to put up with, the difficulty, the frustrations, the power of the insurgency, which we all witnessed and we all saw. Jeff and I, you know, scared our own families a little bit because we both underwent IED attacks and some sniper fire. Some of the things our soldiers did, we decided never to complain because we were there 7 weeks. These guys and women are there for a year from the U.S. Army and from the National Guards, and they're torn away from their families. Some of them are my age. And I'm old, you know, with large families at home who are watching their children grow up, are not there to watch their children grow up and just hope they can come home to them. So this is a story that is impacting our communities, our neighborhoods, our small towns in very real ways. This year, with the rest of the National Guard who are making their way to Iraq and Afghanistan, virtually everybody from the National Guard from Nebraska who can be called up will have been called up to serve in Iraq. Some of the people we were with believe if they stay in the National Guard, they will be going back to Iraq within 2 years. So it is an ongoing and continuing story that's impacting the heartlands and all of our communities. So that's where I'll end, and now we'll take your questions.
Dave and Jeff, thank you very much for that presentation. And I currently have 9 questions. Are there any more that you got a few more? Okay. So we will start out with, do you think embedding with the troops is a good way to cover the war?
It's probably a bad way to cover the war, but it's the only way that it's possible. Given, you know, we just talked about Jill Carroll earlier, who's, you know, still hopefully alive and hopefully will be released. It's impossible to travel. You know, one of the rules I made was I do not want to make a cameo appearance on Al Jazeera. So, you know, being embedded was a way to tell the story from our point of view, and by that I mean the U.S. military's point of view. You don't get a lot of interaction with the Iraqi people. There's very little interaction with the Iraqi people that reporters are able to get. Even those reporters we got, who we met, who had been in 2003, say it's much more dangerous for reporters there today than it was during the initial invasion. If you go out alone, you're asking to be kidnapped, and it's very, very dangerous. I respect those who do. I wouldn't do it. I kind of promised that to my family. I don't have the skills, I think, to survive on the streets of Iraq alone, and we don't have quite the resources to provide a huge security detail, as some of the networks and the New York Times have, to protect their reporters in the field. Embedding does get us out there, and we found it a very good way. Jeff?
even as crazy as my colleagues think, I wouldn't do it unless I was embedded, because it's just too dangerous. And, you know, we look like two white guys. You know, we wouldn't blend in at all. Well, and that's what you got to do.
Did you work much with other reporters and photographers?
I said we didn't run with the pack, so no, we did. There was a reporter from the Des Moines Register there. We ran across. There's a good guy, so I won't mention his name. But Jeff, my good colleague here, ran into one of the soldiers from an Iowa unit, and said, "Hey, the next time you see John, go up to him and say, how come the World Herald is kicking your butt every day?" So it was kind of fun. You know, we did, particularly in Fallujah and some other places. In Ramadi, we didn't really see him. There were not many reporters in most of the places we were. When we were with the Air Force guys at the air base in Baghdad, they told us we were the first reporters who ever embedded with him. I mean, there's, outside of Baghdad itself, you don't run into many reporters, and if you do, they're kind of, it would be waiting for a helicopter, because we'd fly from place to place, space available on military helicopters. And so Jeff ran into a colleague from the San Francisco paper. They traded a few war stories. Where are you going? What are you doing? But not really much.
Were there things you were told by authorities that you could not cover?
You want to do this or
go ahead? You're the reporter.
There were, you know, the things that we were, the rules are you can, you know, everything's on the record. And you can report anything you see. The things they ask you not to do is give out code. Well, I mean, that sounds simple. I mean, as a journalist, you want to use some of the code. When somebody got killed, they went to something called River City Charlie, which, you know, sounds cool to say, you know, put in a story, but you couldn't use it because it meant somebody was killed on the base. The Humvee I was in, which got attacked, the street, I think, was like Center and Cemetery. Now, I wanted to use the street. That's not their real names, but those were actually code names. So those were the kind of minor things we couldn't use. You can't use a casualty if they haven't been announced without their permission. I mean, most of the rules make sense. There are a few things. One of the reasons you can't use these codes and some of these things is the internet. Because of the internet, I mean, they believe that the insurgents, who are very sophisticated, are checking the internet all the time to gather intelligence. So something in the World Herald could end up in the insurgents' hands in Ramadi. And then if they're actually somehow hacking into the military communications, they could actually get a location. One of the journalist groups did get in trouble because there was a mortar attack on the base we were at, and they said the location, they said a guy got killed, and they said the location of it, and it almost got him thrown out of country, because that kind of tells the enemy that here's where you hit, you know, 200 yards from the headquarters. Well, that might help them aim. So,
how did you find the morale of the troops?
The morale was really good. I mean, they're there. They know they're there to do a job, and they want to get it done, and they know the sooner they get it done, the sooner they get to come home. You know, sometimes people ask us, you know, how did the guys feel about Cindy Sheehan or, you know, Bush? That was really never discussed, because a lot of times we didn't know what was going on back home. You know, we were in a camp with 6,000 men, and there was two TVs. And all the network programming is controlled by Armed Forces Television. So, you know, first hour is an hour of CNN, then it's an hour of Fox News, and then it's 2 hours of cartoons. You know, there's just no rhyme or reason to what you saw. And when the guys got on the internet, they only would be allowed a half hour of access time so that everybody would get a turn. Well, the internet was so slow in Ramadi, everybody just took care of their email and got off. You didn't have time to surf, you know, all the websites and like the New York Times or Omaha.com to see what was going on.
At any point, did you feel you were in serious jeopardy of being wounded?
Which time?
I mean, there were several times. We found out that one of the great things about and the bad things about the CAV unit that we were at, the cavalry, was they were outside the base every day. So we kind of found the stories were outside the base, and we wanted to tell their stories. So anytime you left the base, you were in harm's way. And any bag by the road could be an IED, a roadside bomb. So, yeah, you were fearful. And we both, like I said, you know, when something goes boom and you're checking your body parts, you do worry, and then you worry about are there snipers waiting for you. Now, we tried. One of our rules was we wouldn't do something so stupid that it would endanger one of the soldiers' lives we were with. I mean, I think I'd rather, you know, not to sound silly, but I would, you know, that would be something I think Jeff and I would have difficulty living with. If we went, you know, to Gonzo and start running off to try to cover something, a soldier had to accompany us, and he got picked off. I mean, that would have been, you know, very difficult to deal with personally. I would say my biggest fearful time was a story I did on night vision, which required me to go out at night. I was stupid enough to say to the captain, I want to make sure I'm not just in a Humvee. We want to dismount. I want to get out of the Humvee and so I can see how the night vision really works in an urban environment. And it ended up being a mission to the kill zone in the heart of Ramadi at 2 o'clock in the morning. And I'm running around the street with these soldiers. And, yeah, I was scared that time, probably as much as and nothing happened. It turned out to be a perfect mission. That wasn't when I was scared. That was when I was most scared. When we got hit, and Jeff knows this too, you have a sense that you're going to get hit by an IED. It was 4:30 in the afternoon. It was the day before the election. We're roaring down the main street of Ramadi, and there's not a person on the street, not a soul. And you can hear the gunners up top on the Humvees, using a lot of foul language because they know we're in for it today. And sure enough, we turn a corner, kaboom, and the Humvee right behind me was hit, and it had the colonel of the entire brigade in it. And we thought, oh, my God, if we lost the colonel, this is huge. Everybody walked away. And one of the concerns, this goes back to another question, is Captain Searcy brought us in early and said, you know, a lot of our people, we don't tell our families how dangerous it is over here. So we're worried about what you guys are going to say. And what we told him was, okay, Captain, we can't sugarcoat anything, but we are not going to over-dramatize it. So it did affect in some ways how we wrote stories. For example, that story, there could have been a couple ways of writing it. One is to drag it out and tell you at the end everybody walked away. We decided to tell people in the second paragraph, everybody walked away.
Women troops, were they well accepted?
When we were with the CAV, it's a combat unit. And in combat units, there are no women soldiers. So there were 6,000 men and maybe the head 4%. But when we were with the medic units, they were primarily, well, they were about half women, and we found that the women in the Nebraska Medic Corps were probably some of the toughest soldiers that we had ever run into. I mean, they were good soldiers. They weigh 120 pounds soaking wet, you know, full battle load is 74 pounds, plus they're carrying another 30 pounds of gear for life-saving and so on and so forth. But, no, they were all really well-received.
Were there entertainment opportunities for the troops?
Okay, so we're in Ramadi, which is this really dangerous place. You always hear the USO shows are coming around, and no Dallas Cowboy cheerleaders came to Ramadi, no Toby Keith, nobody like that. We were entertained by Billy Banks, the Tybo guy. He was the only USO show to ever be in Ramadi.
But one of the big changes is everybody has a laptop and everybody has their DVDs. And one of the things you can buy over there is the latest movie. It hasn't been out in DVD, but they've got bootleg copies you can buy for a buck. And they've all got their games that they play, you know, the video games on their computers. And we got in, the first place we went was to a transportation company, and it kind of knocked me out. They all had their computers out, but they're at the very end of their mission, and I see five guys all over on the side, and what are they playing? Some macho game? No, Tiger Woods golf. And I thought, what the heck are these, you know, these guys with, you know, they're Army guys. They got a few tattoos and stuff. They're playing Tiger Woods golf. Well, it turns out they had already conquered every violent game. So this is the last game they have to compete on, and that's what they're doing.
Did you spend much of your time with Nebraska troops, and what were your impressions, the quality, the spirit, and the training?
This will sound a little jingoistic, but the Nebraska troops that we were with, I mean, we got the impression they were a cut above. Now, that may just be, I mean, and I can't think of a better example of that than this CAV unit we were with, Troop A of the 167th Cav out of Hastings and Grand Island, but really there are guys from here and all over the state. They're serving with a brigade headed, a Pennsylvania-based brigade. Who does the colonel and his second-in-command pick to be his personal security detail? Two platoons from the Nebraska Cav. He fired the Pennsylvania guys and picked the Nebraska guys. So, I mean, that tells you something about them. Obviously, the medical unit that we talked about that we were with, Sergeant Jameson and those people have been, you know, who was lost, one of the soldiers killed from the National Guard, they've named the medical training facility at one of the major bases after her. And that unit, I mean, performed fabulously. You also had the transportation company, I mean, won all kinds of awards for escaping potentially one of the most deadly ambushes of the war for a transportation company. I mean, these troops from Nebraska, I mean, did perform very well, and we saw it and had greater cohesion, I think, than some of the other National Guard and some of the other regular Army groups that we saw as well.
Were there any problems with equipment, for example, the armor on the Humvees and personal gear, such as armor vests?
One of the first stories we did was on the transportation company. They had, and Jeff shot the pictures, they did not, it was one of the things we found out. The armor on the trucks these guys were driving, if they were regular Army from Kuwait to Mosul, way up into the north and back, through kill zones, if they had been regular Army units in Iraq, transportation company, they would not have been allowed to drive those trucks. So they were under-armored, and that was a big problem. The body armor has been a bigger controversy over here than over there. The controversy over there is how much body armor do you want, and because at some point it restricts your mobility. So while we're adding body armor to them, some of the soldiers are unsure whether they want that much restriction to their mobility and whether it makes them more vulnerable rather than less vulnerable.
Is it true embedded reporters become part of the unit and therefore have their reporting colored by that?
Yes. I mean, we slept with him. We ate with him. We lived with him. We, you know, showered with him. They're keeping us alive. I mean, we are in some ways not part of the unit because we don't have, you know, we don't have weapons. We don't, you know. But is there a kinship that probably, you know, did the guys who, the reporters who, you know, joined the assault on Normandy, did they, you know, I mean, are they kind of homers? Yeah, you are. I mean, these are the people who you're with. Did that, I think, now the question is, how much does that take your coverage? I hope we showed some of the good and the bad of some of these people. I mean, it didn't make us back away from a story on one of the soldiers. And it was one of my favorite stories, which dealt with the difference between heroism and being dumb and making big mistakes. And it didn't back us away from that. We were just in Fort Polk, where we were, again, embedded with a group who are going over to Iraq during their training. I mean, I described the commander in both flattering and unflattering ways. So I think, we aren't trying to show him as saints. And we, you know, but, you know, the one thing we worry about most is, Jeff, tell him what you check every day and why.
The Department of Defense website, you know, where they list the casualties, because you just, I don't know how I won't be very happy if one of these guys ends up losing their life over there.
Given your costs for equipment, travel, and I presume life insurance, what did it cost the World Herald to send you?
Well, I think that's kind of privilege information. So, and you know, they haven't really given me an exact figure. This is the, you mentioned life insurance. We had no extra life insurance. The biggest expense to send anybody to Iraq for us was really to send, to pay for the insurance, because all of our policy, our normal health policy, our normal disability policy, our normal, you know, year salary and insurance policy, normal benefits are all canceled if you go to a war zone. So it was quite expensive for 7 weeks to keep just what we have in place. There was no, you know, there was no $1 million extra policy or anything like that for either of us. So that was actually our number one expense.
What happened to the ABC correspondents recently injured? Were they acting in an unsafe manner?
Yes, but everybody who goes there acts in an unsafe manner. I mean, I'm not a television reporter, but, they were doing a stand-up. Jeff and I can say, doing a stand-up, having your head outside of the vehicle as you're roaring down the street is crazy, but, you know, but then I'd looked at Larry King, who said, made that our executive editor, and I said, hey, Larry, we did some things that we probably shouldn't have over there. I mentioned the night vision thing. I mean, we all, if you're going to get the story, you have to get, you can't do the story just from inside the forward operating base without going out with the troops and experience the dangers they go through.
And after I had made the picture of Burkhart, you know, we were in like Flint with the EOD guys, and we did the story on his first day back, and, you know, they set up the perimeter, and they're all the way back, and they run the robot up to a roadside bomb and think they have it disabled. Well, then, you know, they go up and look at it, and it's like, can I go with you? Well, sure, you know, and, you know, all of a sudden, you know, I was right next to the ordnance, and beforehand, you know, we would never have been allowed to do that.
Well, and I would say he was nuts when he was doing it. I'd look at him and say, Jeff, what the hell are you doing? And then there would be other times that the reporters in the room can probably relate to this. You know, you, as a reporter, you kind of think you're invisible. And so I'm standing in the middle of the street jotting down notes. And I look at Jeff, and he's motioning to me to be down, and I'm looking at the guys, and they're hiding behind rocks, and I'm standing there like I'm – so, you know, it gets a little crazy.
We're getting short on time here, so this question is directed to Dave. What went through your mind to be sitting in the city-county legislative chambers one day and in a combat zone the next, and vice versa?
Well, I mean, I tried to say this when I started. To me, it's one and the same. I mean, the experiences are much different. But, you know, it's all part of what our, you know, what the First Amendment says our job is, to keep a watch on our government. We had the question, how am I going to know if about the body armor and the armor on the trucks if I don't go there, you know? So what we do in the city council or in that, I mean, in many ways, they're moral equivalents, I'd like to say. I mean, I do say that since I'm nearing closer to the end of my career, I would joke some that I had always wanted to cover a war. So when I did it, it didn't come as a huge surprise to my wife. But I also say, you know, maybe it's okay to leave one thing you want to do in your career, you know, the one thing left unchecked, but this was very fulfilling, and I think part of a continuum of for me personally, of my career.
These are two questions. What kind of bureaucracy did you come up against in your trip in Iraq and Kuwait, and do you think the news is slanted naturally toward negative news versus positive?
We get this question a lot. A lot of people say, oh, why don't you show us the good stuff? Why didn't you show us more of the good stuff? We would have loved to have shown more stories about building schools and roads and water supplies and stuff. Ramadi, where we were most of the time, was just too dangerous. I mean, they didn't have the capacity to do that. So it's not slanted that, what you know, for us, it wasn't slanted that we would have loved to tell that story. I mean, Jeff wanted to show, you know, lots of little kids going to school, but when you might get blown up, it's not unusual for the parents not to let their kids go to the schools that we've even built for them. So I don't think, you know, we're there to tell stories. We aren't there to tell good stories or bad stories. We're there to try to reflect what's going on.
These two questions are about the same. What was the attitude of the local residents, and how did the local population relate to the troops you covered?
Again, this is a tough one, and I should have prefaced this. We were almost exclusively in Anbar province, the most insurgent-heavy, almost 99% Sunni. So, you know, it's hard for us to say. We often say we saw Iraq through a straw rather than through, you know, a full wide lens. There may have been places where things were going a lot better. So that, you know, that was part of our problem in trying to make. The other thing is the Iraqi people, the distrust of the Iraqi people was so great that there was very little interaction. And what interaction there was often, you know, first an interrogation, and then you try to make friendly to them. Well, that's, you know, and we wrote about this. That's not going to work very well. How do you, you know, stop a car, make everybody get out, you know, with an M16, as Jeff pointed at their heads, and then, you know, interrogated by an interpreter, and then said, oh, you're okay. Well, we hope you'll vote, and we hope if you have any problems, you'll call us. And if you see any of those insurgents that you say you've never seen, and, you know, each one you stop says, never seen an insurgent. You know, this is right outside the guy's house where an IED has been planted. You know, never seen an insurgent. We love the coalition forces. You know, it doesn't ring true for the soldiers. So there's a natural friction there. We were there at a time when they had no police in Ramadi, and the Iraqi security forces were just being trained. Since then, they're trying to get a police. I mean, imagine Douglas County, no police. I mean, Ramadi was 450,000 people. There was no police force. other than the U.S. Army and Marines. That's not a very good environment for anybody. And maybe that's a good place to, we're about ready to stop. At the end of it, we kind of ask, why isn't there more cooperation? And a two-star general, Marine general, who had responsibility for the whole province said, they don't know which side's going to win. So why would you choose sides before you're, and they don't know whether the Americans are going to stay or pull out. So why would they jump on one side or the other? They're just waiting to see the outcome of the struggle, which is kind of, when you think of it, a normal and rational human response to a horrible situation. Maybe that's a good...
We've got one more that we can try, and we will end on a marketing note. Is there a book collection available of your stories and photos?
I think you can still go on omaha.com and in with that note, and you'll find and what special reports there's at war and at home, and all you'll find, you'll actually find some audio of some of the interviews. You'll find full galleries of pictures and all of the stories, both the ones that our very good staff did here at home, as well as what we did from Iraq.
David, Jeff, thank you very much for sharing that with us and coming out today. And thank you all for coming out to listen to them. We'll see you next month.
You've been listening to a luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. Today's speakers were Dave Kotok, veteran journalist with the Omaha World Herald, and World Herald staff photographer Jeff Bundy. Their topic was Covering Nebraskans at War. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Thursday, March 16, 2006, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to the Omaha Press Club Education Committee for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The Omaha Press Club holds these noontime educational forums each month. If you'd like to attend future forums in the series, call the Omaha Press Club at 345-8008. These events are open to both members and non-members of the Omaha Press Club. The Omaha Press Club is located on the 22nd floor of the First National Center, 16th and Dodge, in downtown Omaha. Complete noon forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.